This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Touro College. Whether you're looking for a career in business, finance or accounting, health sciences, medicine or dentistry, Touro has a program for you. At Touro, you get more of everything that's important to you. More career options, more personal attention and more accelerated pathways to leading graduate and professional programs in multiple fields. Touro offers a high quality education surrounded by people with your values and all the training you need to succeed in your chosen profession. This episode is a conversation with Dr. Moshe Sokol, Dean of Touro's Lander College for Men, where students enjoy extensive Touro study combined with a full college campus experience. Devoted Rebbeim and engaged faculty support students along their journey of personal and academic growth. To learn more, visit www.touro.edu. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Rabbi Dr. Moshe Sokol, who is the Dean of Lander College for Men and the Rabbi of the Yavne Minyan of Flatbush. And we will be discussing his new book, which was just published by Magid, which is Koren Publishers, which is The Snake at the Mouth of the Cave, Exploring Talmudic Narratives, which is basically on Agadata in different various Agadic stories. So we'll discuss that and various themes about Agadata. So thank you very much, Rabbi Sokol, for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's always good to talk to a fellow Philly alumnus.
So why don't we start over there? Why don't we start off, tell the listeners about yourself and your background.
Okay, so remarkably enough, I grew up in the Catskills. Nachi, you're looking puzzled. My father is a graphic designer. And in those days, every time he started working, when it came to an early Erev Shabbos, he was fired, but they wouldn't hire him. So he got a job in Channel Master, which was a big company up in the Catskills. And that's how we ended up there. That's where I grew up. My parents were amongst the founders of the Hebrew Day School of Sullivan and Ulster County. You've probably seen it on Route 42, maybe not. But I was in the first graduating class of that school, elementary school. And then for high school, it was either Monticello Public High or bust, since Monticello Public High was not an option for my family, obviously. So I went to Yeshiva Philadelphia, made a connection through some, I heard about it through some member of family connection. I was there for 7 years, high school and base medrash. It was really from being a transformative period in my life. Going from Monticello to Philly Yeshiva was quite a culture shock. But Baruch Shem, it really worked, I hope, extremely well for me. I learned how to learn, and I learned what it is to be a Ben Torah and to be a Ben Yeshiva. Not that I wasn't raised the way I was, but Philly was the big leagues for me. After that, I went to Yeshivat Itri in Yerushalayim, learned there and got smicha there, came back to the United States, enrolled in Brooklyn College, which is where everybody seemed to be going. YU was not exactly on the radar screen if somebody went to Philly. So I learned in Tor Vadas and went to Brooklyn College. I took a degree in philosophy and comparative literature, and then went on to the University of Pennsylvania, where I received a PhD in philosophy. And shortly after that, I started my career at Touro College, teaching philosophy, doing some administrative work, and that's basically been my academic home ever since I got my PhD.
So, like I mentioned, we're here to discuss the book on that just came out. I mean, we'll see when this is posted, but still, it'll be pretty new. So, it's on Agadata. I mean, why Agadata? How did this book come to be, and why did you decide to write a book on Agadata? I mean, you mentioned this in the introduction, but there are not many English academic kind of or just thorough books dedicated to Agadata. So why is that something that you chose to do?
Right. That's a great question. So there are multiple layers of answer to that question. First of all, my academic career is in Jewish philosophy, and I've published a fair amount in that field in technical Jewish philosophy. And in addition, in my shul, Yavne Minyan of Flatbush, for decades, I've been giving Gemara Shiurim, and I try to teach Be'ion to the best of my ability. And we would come up to Agadotas as well, because that's just the nature of things. And so just as I was learning that, everything else Be'ion, I began to learn the Agadotas Be'ion as well. And I found them to be so stimulating and so profound as I was just giving the shiurim that I really, I guess you might say, got into it. And it kind of drew also on my interest in literature, because there was obviously really a brilliant literary dimension to the extraordinary Mahabre Haggadah, who knew exactly what they were doing and writing with exceptional care. So it kind of moved in that direction, incidentally, so to speak, to my academic career, but part of my Rabbanus. And then a number of years ago, I started giving shiurim at Lander at the school in what I call the Agadah to Be'in. And I would take various Agadahs and learn them Be'in. You know, we have wonderful, wonderful Rabbeim and Rosh Yeshiva who teach classical sugyas. I have nothing to add to that. These are people who devote their lives to classical learning. I do other things too. But I felt, oh, who's teaching Agadahs? So I thought that would be a lacuna that I could fill, given my interest in the area and given my background in giving shiurim in that area as well in the shul. So that's how it kind of evolved. And it's something that has really totally preoccupied me, me intellectually and spiritually, because there's so much there. So that's how it evolved.
Now, were you always into, like you said, were you always interested in Agadah? I mean, when you were back in yeshiva, was that something? I know in yeshiva, Bekiyas, the Elul learns Bekiyas, so they go through when you learn an Agadah, Gemara. Some yeshivas skipped the sugyas, and I remember from Philly, they actually didn't. You know, they would learn it, but you would just go through it if it came up, you know, second Seder or whenever, first Seder, it probably didn't come up. But, I mean, was that something that you're into, or just like everyone else, you just learned the basics and you just moved on?
Well, in those days, it was pretty much like everybody else. You know, classic yeshiva learning is the lechem abasar of a sugya, is a classical sugya. And when I did come across an Agadah, I would probably think more about it maybe than most, but that was not the focus of my learning. I was very interested in Maral at that time, so I learned the Maral's Perushim on Agadah, which was kind of a phase in my own intellectual and spiritual growth at that time. But it wasn't something that I really, really focused on seriously until I began to give shiurim in Gemara on my shul.
So now the other one I think we didn't answer before. I mean, you mentioned this in your introduction, right? I don't think there are a lot of even English books like this really dedicated to Agadah. And I know that art school is now doing Ein Yaakov, for example. That's the famous Agadah, but like that's a different kind of thing. I'm just mentioning, like, it's just like a current, but I just mean even that, it's just current. Like, there was nothing really till then. No one's really, is there a reason for that? And is that another reason why you decided to publish the book?
Well, that's a very good question. And there is an asymmetry between what's going on in Israel in this regard and what's going on in the United States. In Israel, there is a profusion of svarim on Agadah, written by people who are academics in the field, people who have academic training but are writing for a more popular audience. And it's a whole new genre of literature, which is really not matched in the United States. The father of the field is a man by the name of Professor Yonah Frankel, who taught at the Hebrew University. And he, in some ways, is the progenitor of academic study of Agadah as a branch, so to speak, of Talmud study. And his students and students of students, even those who did not enter the academic field per se, began to write more and more books on the subject. My derech and my approach is entirely my own, but there is a literature out there in Israel. In the United States, we haven't yet caught up in English. Just recently, I would say there are a couple of more popular books that were published after I had submitted my book for publication and before they actually came out, my book actually came out. I guess the leading figure in academic Jewish studies in Agadah in the United States is Jeffrey Rubinstein at New York University. He's published a number of books on studies in Agadah, Johns Hopkins University Press. And they are very academic and written for other academics, although they can be read by others, but that's the primary audience. And he uses the jargon and the methodology of those who are engaged in the academic study of the Talmud. So it's not something that all Orthodox Jews would feel comfortable with, let's just say. He just recently published a new book called The Land of Truth, which is a popularization of his studies in Agadah and an attempt to kind of bring them to current audience. Rabbi Ari Kahn just published a book, I have it here, called The Crowns on the Letters, which is also a study of Agadah. So there's beginning to be a bit of a literature on this in English. But it's still, I think, a major desideratum. In the United States, there's just been this constant enduring focus on the lechem u'basar of a classic sugya. And that's what yeshivas focus on. And that's probably the way it should be. Professor Isidore Twersky, for example, coined the term halachocentricity. And Judaism has always been centered around halacha and the learning of Gemara as the paideia, the curriculum for what it means to be an educated Jew. So particularly after the Holocaust, there was a tremendous need to rebuild that kind of serious Talmud Torah, and that's the yeshiva world, and that's the way it should be. But as a result of all that focus, there has been, I would say, far less attention in the yeshiva world and in the modern Orthodox world and the world in general out there on Agadas. And I think that's unfortunate. I certainly don't believe that the lechem u'basar of Talmud Torah and a yeshiva should change. But, you know, people expand their horizons. If you look at the bookshelf of a typical yeshiva bachur today, it looks pretty different from the bookshelf of a typical yeshiva bachur in my day. Like, nobody in my day would ever learn Sifrei Chassidus. Nobody knew what it was. Svasemis, didn't he read Perush and Gemara? In other words, yet as Baruch Hashem, there's more Talmud Torah and there's a greater development and many more people learning Torah, there's a greater variety of interests, which is healthy because Baruch Hashem Yiddishkeit, Yahadut has lots and lots of resources. And I think Agadah should be in there as a part of the mix because this is not 19th century. This is Chazal. I'm not a Bakian Shas by any means, to say the least, but people who are Bakian have estimated that 30% of Shas is Agadot. If you count Midrashim as a part of the literature of Chazal, then the percentage shoots way up higher. So if Chazal invested so much time and energy in Agadot, then it behooves us to at least pay careful attention to it as well, because why else is included in the Gemara? It's important. And it's important in a variety of ways, which we'll eventually get into the more our discussion proceeds. But that's, I guess, the first point I'd make.
Right. I'd also point out it's not only the halacha centric. I know because a lot of the sugyas that are learned in yeshiva, I mean, are not the contemporary halacha now in Baba Kamla and what's. I mean, that's the Chofetz Chaim's famous thing. He wanted everyone to learn kachim because he says what they learn and don't tell me halacha lamaisa because it's not neger. There's no knas today. There's none of this stuff today. So I'm just pointing out. I think it's more alumnus thing or it's, you know, I mean, it's always been throughout the generations. I think it seems to be more be'in than Agadot, which came like Bekiyas. Obviously, you have Svarim written on Agadot, and you have the Marsha dedicates a lot of time. You just said the Maral wrote, we have from him, and we have others. There are other Svarim. But Lamaisa, that was more where
that's what I say. That's the Lechem u'Basar of Yiddishkeit, is how we should lead our lives. And even if it's not relevant today, but it's still halacha. I mean, Hilchos Kachim, it's in the Rambam, it's in Mishneh Torah. You know, it's halacha, except that it's not relevant today. And Mirtz Hashem and Mashiach should come, and it should be relevant, but right now it's not. But it's still how practically we are supposed to conduct our lives. And that's so much what makes Yiddishkeit distinctive amongst the world religions, that it's all focused on here's what you need to do.
Right, I guess that's true. That's a good point. I bet a lot of this stuff comes either comes to Shulchan Aruch or a Torah. So, I mean, so I guess the question will be, so let's focus a little bit on the book. So what angle do you take on Agadot? So what you said your approach is new, is novel. What are you bringing here? And just in general, what approach are you bringing to Agadot? And you're saying, here's what I'm going to do.
Okay, great question. At one level, the answer is En Kol Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh. I mean, there's nothing totally new. So what methodology do I take myself to be employing in my analysis of Agadot? So to start, as I'll say that the derech I learned from my wonderful rabbeim in yeshiva over the many years I was there was analyze every single word of the Gemara carefully. Why does the Gemara use this word? Why does the Gemara not use this word? Why does the Gemara ask this kasha? They could have asked another kasha. Why does the Gemara give this teretz when they could have given another teretz? Rabbi Yochanan says such and such here, but he says such and such over there. How can we reconcile the two Rabbi Yochanans? Every single word, line, nuance of the Gemara was the appropriate focus for what people nowadays call interrogation. We need to interrogate the Gemara. Ask, because after all, we believe that the Gemara has enormous wisdom. Well, wait a minute. These are the same Mechabrei HaGemara. If we take that Derech HaLimud for, I'll call it classical Gemaras, that is the Gemaras that are classically the subject of Talmud Torah, why shouldn't I take the same methodology that my Rebbeim taught me so effectively and apply that to a Gadarta and ask many, many questions? Don't be afraid to ask Kashas. You mean that doesn't really make sense? Well, let's think about it. If it doesn't make sense to me, why did the Gemara say it? Why did Reish Lakish do this? Why did Rabbi Yochanan do this? Why did Rabbi Elazar say this? He said it. It seems difficult to understand. So that doesn't mean, well, let's just zoom over it and kind of ignore it because it makes us feel uncomfortable. That's not the way we learn any Sugya and Shas. So we need in a Gadarta too to confront every word, every line, because this is the Gemara. This is our Masorah. This is the, you know, this is what makes us who we are as Am Yisrael. And let's learn that with exceptional care, nuance, reflection, and honesty. Don't make believe that you understand something when you don't. The best advice that any novice Rebbe can give to a novice Talmud is don't fool yourself. Don't think you understand Reb Baruch Ber if you don't. Don't think you understand Taisus if you don't. You need to be very careful about what it says. Why does it say it? How can I understand it? A good Rebbe will go through every line with great care. It's a kind of, it's called a blotchier. So that, now what emerges from that? What ideally emerges from that very rigorous, careful, nuanced study of every word and phrase and kasha and teretz of the Gemara is a picture of the sugya. You try to put together the building blocks of the sugya after that very careful analysis so that you've got a sense of what the svaris are, what the issues are, what the machlokes are, what are they debating. Well, my goal was to apply exactly that method, that Derech HaLimud, to Agadita. Now, the tools necessary for applying that successfully are a little different in that in order to answer some of the kashas about the Agadita, you need to have certain kind of information. You need to have a certain kind of sensibility, a certain awareness of what was going on in the lives of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, what was going on in the intellectual history of the period, where were they living, what were their machlekesin about, what was their biographical background, because the Gemara often shares with us information about the biographical background of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish and all the many, many Gedolim. Will that help us understand these stories that the Gemara tells about these great Gedolim? And here I want to make what for me is a really, really important point. So you will permit me to stress this. This is in italics, okay? And underlined and in bold. I make no claim whatsoever about what Rabbi Yochanan was really like or Reish Lakish was really like or anybody I write about was really like. There is no way that Moshe Sokol, living in the 21st century, with his madriga as it is, can even begin to imagine what somebody as great as our Tanayim or Amarayim were like. We can't. It's totally impossible. But we have a job to do. As long as we recognize that we can't get entree into the hidden recesses of the neshama of such great Gedolei Yisrael, but nevertheless, there's a Gemara here. And what I'm trying to do is interpret the Gemara. Because the Gemara was written, whoever wrote the Memra, the Baal Memra, the Misadrei HaGemara included it in the Gemara, because they wanted this Gemara to teach Moshe Sokol or Nachi or anybody else something, because that's why they included it. They didn't include it because they wanted to entertain us. You know, we could turn on the internet and entertain ourselves. They wanted to teach us something. Every serious, I think, learner of the Gemara needs to figure out, what is this Baal Memra trying to teach? Why does he say this and that? And why is he making these somewhat very puzzling claims? He wants to teach me something. Now, what he wants to teach me may not bear on the truth of what Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish was like, because we can't know what Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish was like, or Rabbi Eliezer, or Choni Ma'agel, whoever it is. So we have to be very, very modest in our ambitions. And I make no claims whatsoever to even have any hasaga about great Amorayim and Tanayim, but I do have a job to do. Every one of us has a job to do. If it's in the Gemara, we have to learn up the Gemara like we have to learn up every Gemara. And that's our job. And that's what we have to do to the best of our abilities.
So practically, how do you actually know and apply that? An example.
Okay, well, I'll give you one example. I mean, there are many examples. I mean, there are 8 chapters in the book. So, I mean, the book really, well, let me say a word about the title of the book, maybe before I get into that. So the title of the book is a little odd. It's called The Snake at the Mouth of the Cave. So at one level, I chose the title so that somebody walking through a bookstore might be arrested by it. Oh, you know, I got it. Oh, I got it. Okay, let me pass that by there, you know, whatever. I tried to choose a title that I thought would attract attention, to be perfectly honest. But where does it come from and why did I choose it? So it comes from, I'm talking about examples, this is an example. It comes from an Agadah about Rabbi Yochanan and Rav Kahana. And it's a long, long, long Agadah, but the relevant part of that Agadah and the whole, I analyzed the whole Agadah in the chapter, but the relevant part tells that Rabbi Yochanan, in an interaction with Rav Kahana, another great, great Amora, thought that Rav Kahana smirked at him. And Rav Yochanan, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Tiberia, the Gadol Hadar, was very upset that this Rav Kahana was from Bavel and was a yet much younger man, was smirking at him. And as a result of Rav Yochanan's feeling offended, Rav Kahana dies, which is pretty serious if you're Rav Kahana or anybody else. And Rabbi Yochanan the next day goes back to yeshiva and he tells the yeshiva, you see what happened? Rav Kahana died. He smirked at me. And his talmidim said, no. He didn't smirk at you. He has a lip defect. It just looks like a smirk. Can you imagine how Rabbi Yochanan felt? So Rabbi Yochanan goes to the cave where Rav Kahana is buried to seek forgiveness, appropriately so, given the gadol that he was. So there is a snake at the mouth of the cave, which is blocking Rav Yochanan from entering to meet up with Rav Kahana and to do tshuva and to ask mechila, ask forgiveness. The snake refuses to allow Rav Yochanan entree into the cave until Rav Yochanan says the right code. The right code, as it happens, if you learn the Gemara, you read the chapter in the book, is that after Rav Yochanan tries a few times, Rav Yochanan, Rav Kahana is my colleague, he's my chaver. Finally, what works is he says, Rav Kahana is my Rebbe. And the snake then allows him entree into the cave. I could talk more about the Agadah in a minute, but that's where the title of the book comes from. But it has another significance for me personally, which is that Agadotas, as we learn them superficially, seem to be utterly mysterious, as hidden, dark, recessed, and sinuous as a cave. And there is a snake at the mouth of the cave, which makes it very hard for us to penetrate like spelunking explorers to get to the bottom of the cave. What is the deepest, deeper meanings of Chazal, of the Agadotas? You need to know the right code to get in. So this book is my attempt to offer a code to get into and plumb the depths of the hidden labyrinthian recesses of Chazal's profound thinking. So that's both where the title comes from and what it signifies for me personally as I gave the book that title. Now, let me kind of get back to the question you started with, which is, how do these insights or methodology play out? So what was going on at that time was there was tension between Bavel as a merkaz of Talmud Torah at the same time as Eretz Yisrael being a merkaz of Talmud Torah. Rabbi Yochanan was the Rosh Yeshiva in Tiberia. He was the heir to the great, great, great Torah of all the Tanaim who lived in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Yehuda HaNasi, Yochanan ben Sakai, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Akiva, all Eretz Yisrael. Now, this is after the Churban and after the dispersion of Talmidei Chachamim, many to Bavel or some to Bavel. Rabbi Yochanan was the bastion of Torah in Eretz Yisrael, and Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah. That's where Torah scholarship must reside. That's where the Sanhedrin resided. Now, on the other hand, Rav and Shmuel, at roughly the same time, had established what you might say are competing Merkezei HaTorah, competing yeshivas in the north and southern part of Bavel. Now, Rav and Shmuel were Gedolei Olam, and they had many extraordinary Talmidim. Where would the center of Talmud Torah, of Torah authority, of halachic authority, of learning reside? Would it be in Eretz Yisrael with the great, great traditions of Talmud Torah? Or would it be moved to Bavel? And wait a minute, there's another factor as well. The Derech HaLimud in Bavel was very different than the Derech HaLimud in Eretz Yisrael. The Derech HaLimud, at least according to various Chazal, Yerushalmi and Bavli, look at the difference between Talmud Yerushalmi and Talmud Bavli, which is longer. Talmud Bavli is much, much longer. It's filled with machlokas after machlokas after machlokas after machlokas. Whereas the Talmud Yerushalmi, which of course has machlokas, is much more irenic. It's much less argumentative. It's a more peaceful. And the Gemara says this. The various Gemara says compare and contrast the Torah's Eretz Yisrael with the Torah's Bavel. The Torah's Bavel was very, very argumentative. Kahana was a perfect exemplar of that aggressive style of Talmud Torah. You go into a Beis Medrash today in a yeshiva. Here the guy's yelling, oh, you idiot, how can you say such a foolish svara? That's really, I don't think anybody should say that. But it's a very argumentative environment, and that ultimately comes from the Derech HaLimud of Bavel, which is very, very argumentative. And Eretz Yisrael, you learned the Masorah, there was a Kabbalah, Rebbe going all the way back. Of course, there were machlokes there. You say they weren't. Obviously, there were. But if you compare the two, so what Derech HaLimud is going to reign supreme for the rest of Jewish history? Is it going to be the Derech HaLimud in Eretz Yisrael, which Rabbi Yochanan brilliantly exemplified, the Masorah, respect for a Rebbe, learn what your Rebbe teaches you, memorize what your Rebbe teaches you? Or is it going to be the Vikuach and the arguments and the drama of Talmud Torah and Bava? Totally different drachim. Rabbi Yochanan could not believe or accept that the center of Torah learning would depart from Eretz Yisrael HaKadosha and move to Bavel. What are they doing in Bavel? The Masorah is ours. But on the other hand, Rav Kahana asked Rabbi Yochanan so many kashas, and Rabbi Yochanan couldn't get answer them. And at the end of this Agadata, Rabbi Yochanan, the Gemara says, asked after this dramatic story Rabbi Yochanan does or doesn't do Tchias Mason Rav Kahana, it's a whole interesting what actually happens. But at the end of the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan asks Rav Kahana every single shaila he has, and guess what? Rav Kahana answers it. And then Rabbi Yochanan admits that the Torah is ultimately the Torah of Bavel. Rabbi Yochanan was struggling with, and his conflict with Rav Kahana was about where the truth of Torah would rely. And Rabbi Yochanan couldn't imagine it could leave Eretz Yisrael. But Rav Kahana demonstrated the power of the aggressive bikuchim and arguments that constituted the Derech HaLimud of Bavel. And it can get a little nasty. The Gemara says, Yerushalmi there is bitter as olives in Bavel. It's a rough, rough Derech HaLimud. People can be offended. And look what happened to Rav Yochanan. He was offended by Rav Kahana. And look what happened to Rav Kahana. He died. Very difficult, challenging issue. So you see the larger background, the canvas of the lives of great Amoraim or Tanaim, enable us to see why they felt so deeply and strongly about what they did. And that kind of helps unlock some of the mysteries of these Agadotas and shows really how great these Talmidei Chachamim were and the principles which they sacrificed their lives for.
So very interesting. So perhaps you would like to give another example. I know you talk about the famous Agadat of Chana Magal, and as you told me, the Jewish Ruffin Winkle. So maybe perhaps you want to discuss more particular approach you take there? And also just asking about a famous Agarata that people may know as a story, but maybe they don't know, as you mentioned before, the reason for the book, and going in depth on Agarata, maybe how to analyze it.
Right. That's, I think, an interesting example, because it is an extremely famous Agarata, obviously within from circles, but as little kids, you know, children's storybooks include some story about Koniyama Agel. And actually, in the non-Orthodox world, it's as well become very popular because of the ecology movement, which I'm not going to go into that part of the Agarata. But it's become very, very famous for lots of good reasons, and maybe reasons that aren't so great, but it is very, very famous. The part of the Agarata that I will focus on, Koniyama Agel was a fascinating figure. I mean, he was Ugo, the Mishnah says, there was a drought, and he said, Hashem, I'm not leaving this circle unless you bring rain. Ma pitom, what is he threatening HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Like, what is that supposed to mean? So how we'd understand Koniyama Agel as the Godol that he was, because he was a great miracle worker. And so I really work hard to try to understand it. It's related to another part of the Agarata, also quite well known. It says, Shira Malas B'Shiva Shemesh Shiva Sion Hayinu Kicholmim. We were like dreamers during the period of time, the 70 years that we were in exile. Choni asked the Kasha. Kasha is, what do you mean we were dreaming for 70 years? Who can dream for 70 years? What is Hayinu Kicholmim? Who could dream for seven? Who could sleep and dream for 70 years? Now, that kasha, if I were to have asked that kasha, my Rebbe would have probably banged me on the head, and he would have said, Sokol, what kind of a question is that? It says specifically, Kicholmim. We were light dreamers. What do you think that the author of that Shira Malas meant that they literally slept and dreamed? What are you thinking? What kind of a kasha is that? Now, Rechoni was obviously a very, 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 he's a gadol, a smart man. He could have figured that out. So, like, as we say in yeshiva language, like, what's the havamim? Like, what is he thinking? What kind of a question is that? And then he sees a man planting a carob tree at 70 years. Oh, I see. And he falls asleep. So the story unfolds, as you may recall, that he falls asleep. He has some lunch. Rocks grow up around him. And he's surrounded by this mysterious rock growth, like a fortress. He sleeps. Turns out, as the Gemara develops, I can't go into the details, he was sleeping for 70 years. Oh, I see, I could sleep 70 years. He meets up with his donkey, has lots of foals. And then he goes to his family and he says, oh, I'm Choni, I'm a Agel, knocks on the door, here I am. Nobody believes him. I ask you the following question. If some elderly gentleman came to your door in Tom's River and knocked on the door and said, I'm related to you, your response probably would not be to slam the door in his face. You might have invited him in. He's an old man. Yeah, a cup of coffee, maybe a tea. Tell me how we're related. I mean, it's shocking that they would treat him that way. It just seems totally, I mean, they say, you know, where's my son? He's no longer alive. My grandson, basically, he's not welcome in his own house. Okay, that doesn't work. So he goes to the Beis Medrash. And then the people who are learning Gemara in the Beis Medrash say, oh, Torah is so bright now in our Beis Medrash, like in the good old days when Choniyama Agel was here to teach us Torah. Knocks on the door. I'm Choniyama Agel. Uninterested. They essentially boot him out. Now, I ask you the following question. An elderly man, they're kicking him out of the Beis Medrash. They're not really welcoming him. And why don't they say, oh, could you tell, we're learning this sugya. What do you say about this halacha? What is your perspective? They basically ignore him. So as a result, Chonis says, Tavruso Misusa, it's like it's not worth living, and he dies. Very puzzling. I mean, the Agarata is puzzling from beginning to end. So I'm not going to go into my attempt the best of my ability to figure out what Choni's theology was. Like, what did he think? Why did he ask that question? What's his ug uga? That's a whole other discussion. But I will focus on one part, particularly given the limited time that we have together. And that is not being accepted in his own house in the Beis Medrash. What does that mean? And what's with this rocks growing up? When is the last time you saw rocks grow up and surrounding somebody like a fortress? Not to mention sleeping for 70 years. So how we'd understand that? So some people will interpret it literally and call it kavod. But I came across, if you think about the code to the snake at the mouth of the cave, I came across, not in this Gemara, but an approach to understanding agaditas that are, how should I say, entirely at odds with our experience of the world, which seemed just bizarre. And I found that to be very helpful in many ways. And I use this as an example for that. Derek, I use it in a couple of chapters in this book. I have a whole long chapter devoted to this approach in the Mirtz Hashem, my next volume, which I am working on. So this is relates to the broader question, how are we to understand agaditas or midrashim that don't comport with what we, our experience of the world? So there's a big debate there, the literalist and the allegorist, the figurative. There are many different approaches, which, as I say, I discuss in the second volume, which I'm working on. But for our purposes now, I'm going to mention one particular approach, which works, to my mind, well for certain kinds of agaditas. Starts with the Rambam. He alludes to it. It's rationalist. Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam is very explicit about it. The Ritva says this in certain places. Rav Haigon says this in certain places. Not in these Gemaras that I discuss. But what they say is, if you find a Gemara that doesn't, or a Gadato or a Medrash that doesn't comport with what we know of the world, maybe it was a dream. Maybe it was a dream. And they apply this, amongst other Ritva applies this, the famous series of Agaditas in Bava Metzi about these Tanaim who took these trips to the sea. And they saw these huge monsters and wild, wild, you remember that Gemara? Wild, wild stories and wild pictures, images. And the Ritva says, you know, they may have fallen asleep after their trip in the sea. And this is what they dreamt. They dreamt about sea monsters. So there is, Maratz Chayes actually is a whole chapter in which he collects many, many Rishonim and Gaonim that offer this as a suggestion for dealing with these kinds of agaditas. Now, coming at it from both a modern and a classical perspective, what does the Gemara say in Brachas? Gemara in Brachas Perek Aroa says, what do we dream about? So the Gemara says we dream about what we think about during the day. And that's, of course, sometimes the case. We dream about what we're worried about or what we think about, what our anxieties are. We all know that's part of our living experience. The Gemara says that. Now, if you take that seriously, consider how this gives us a portal into understanding some of the most mysterious agaditas we have. Because if there can be taken to be dreams, we need to look at the history, the cultural background, the times, in this case, say that Choni HaMa'agya lived, as a framework for trying. Look, to me, it sounds like a dream. Rocks grow up, right? Doesn't have a dreamlike quality? You know how crazy stuff happens in dreams? And you go to your house and nobody, you talk to your wife and she's not interested in talking to you, or your kids and they're interested in talking to you, or you go to the Beis Medrash and your Chaverim ignore you. Doesn't it sound like a dream? It's a dreamlike quality. And I think that these Rishonim and Gaonim give us a kind of a code, you know, the snake at the mouth of the cave. It's a way of thinking about this, which enables us to reflect about Choni's life. And again, I can't go into all the detail, but just a very, very limited, broad strokes. Choni was living at a time of great transition in how Klal Yisrael lived their religious lives. How do you deal with drought? So we have a whole Maseches Tainis, which tells us how to deal with the drought. Maseches Tainis includes stories about great Gedolim, great Tanaim, or Amoraim, who davened and who tried to bring an end to drought, and Choni had his Aguga, he drew the circle. if you look at the Gemaras, you'll see that in a way there is a transition. Chone Me'agil was an Ish Kadosh, and he was a miracle worker, like Rabbi Hanina Mendoza. They could just perform miracles. They are coming at the tail end of Nevuah. Nevi'im, Eliyahu, great Nevi'im, they can perform Nisim too. And when we had Tsaris or problems, we would go to the great Nevi'im, and they would tell us what to do. They had direct access to Hashem. Choni, Ama'agel, Hanina Bendosa, others like them, were these great Kedoshim who had the special access to Hashem. Shimon ben Shetach, who was the Gadol Hador of his era at the same time as Choni Ma'agel, said, you know, if it were up to me, I would really ban you. What is this? How can you talk to Hashem like that? But he says you are like a child in Hashem's house. Hashem loves you, and this is he'll do it for you because he just loves you. We can talk about how to understand that. But the idea is that Choni had this intimate relationship with Hashem, like the great Nevi'im, and you turn to a miracle worker and he would perform miracles. It's like some people think about or thought about Hasidish or Rebbes. Tsaris, you go to the Rebbe, and he'll daven for you, going back several centuries. You go to the Rav or the Rebbe, they write a Kameya for you, and they make things happen. Special entree into HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Pamal Yishalmal. But the overall thrust of the rabbinic tradition was away from those models. What's Maseches Tainis? It's a whole series of halachas and behaviors, the Tainis, and then they gather together people for tefillah. It's a whole series of things. It's very, very, it's a very elaborate, you might say, ritual process to cope with a drought. That's not Choni. That's a different approach. It's like we Jews need to take responsibility for our own destinies in our own hands. We need to daven. We need to fast, Highness. We need to take charge of our own religious lives and our own destinies to bring us to a Yeshua. It's not turning to in an inadequate way. Turning to a miracle worker like Choni, Choni, you handle it. It's your job. You've got this relationship with Hashem, and I'm going to continue going about doing what I always do. It was a transition. And Shimon ben Shetach models the transition from a Choni miracle worker, Navi-type persona as an ideal religious figure to the Talmud Chacham, cool analysis, learning, learn Maseches Tainis, daven with Kavana, do your Tanisim, fast carefully. That's where. So there's a radical shift in how we Jews are supposed to think about our destiny, our role in our destiny, our well-being, our relationship with Hashem. Do we delegate it to somebody else or do we take charge ourselves? And Choni saw in the negative reaction that Shimon ben Shetach had towards him, because of course he knew about it, that maybe he was on the losing side of history. And maybe he is a kind of vestigial figure as Klal Yisrael marched towards the focus on Talmud Torah, on Tefillah, which is what's our lives. It's learning Gemara. It's learning Torah. It's davening. That's not the Choni Ma'agel model. And he was a kind of a vestigial, quasi-prophetic figure. Well, if you think of it in those historical terms, then that's what Choni is dreaming about, if you take it to be a dream. My family doesn't recognize me anymore. The Beis Medrash doesn't recognize me anymore because my way of relating to Hashem is not something that the future can relate to. They don't have the intimate ug-uga relationship that I have with Hashem. It's learn, 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 daven, daven, fast, fast. And so there's a poignancy to Choni's feelings about his status in society. Here he's this Ish Kadosh. He has this incredible relationship with Hashem. Time is passing him by. And it wouldn't surprise me, given what was going on in that time, if that's what he dreamt about. O Chavrusa Misusa, the role of Kadoshim like him, just like Nevuah no longer exists anymore, was passing him by. And he was on the wrong side of history. And it wouldn't surprise me if he were to dream about that, because I think if I were anybody like Honi, which of course I'm not, I would probably dream something similar too. So here you see how this approach that the Rishonim first developed, thinking about difficult agadotas as dreams, provides somebody who is alert to the historical and psychological dimensions of the human condition, can now read into these strange agadotas deep and profound reflections about what it is to be a Jew, how times change, how should we focus ourselves. There's so much there.
Fascinating. So I think the other thing that we should mention is a couple of things I want to mention. First of all, we didn't even talk about the other chapters, which we're not going to get to. But the bulk, I mean, there are three, I think, dedicated to Rabbi Eliezer alone. So I'll let you talk a little bit about just what the other chapters are about. Obviously, someone can buy the book and read it.
I hope they do.
Yeah.
I wrote it.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, just as a practical matter of the book that I liked and I wanted to point out, is that in each story, so to speak, you start off the chapter with the Gemara in the Hebrew or the Aramaic, but not in the English, the actual text. And each you break it up kind of paragraph of the original plus then there's an English translation, then there's a paragraph again, then there's a translation, and then you go in depth into analyzing it. So I think that's very nice, because someone can actually read the, not the sugya, but kind of, so to speak, and they can get an understanding either in the, again, Hebrew Aramaic, the original, or the English, rather than just having English. Sometimes it's very clunky to someone that's used to learning more on the regular, or vice versa. So I think that's very nice. I wanted to point that out. Like I said, talk about the other chapters. I guess I'll throw it in here. I know it's kind of the same thing. Is that, what sources do you use? You kind of alluded to this a bunch of times, but so you mentioned before, you're going off of, the Rambam and Rambam, the Ritva, et cetera, and you're borrowing their approach. But are there others? Do you use Marsha? Do you use Inyak? Do you use other classical? And also, do you use the academics that you mentioned, or maybe other academics that you sources that you mentioned, or other totally different sources that you bring in?
Okay, so ala Rishon, Rishon, vala Achron, Achron. So to answer your first question first, the book consists of a trilogy of chapters on Rabbi Eliezer. The first chapter is based on an analysis of Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is a light medrash, although they're very similar stories told in earlier medrashim. And it describes Rabbi Eliezer's origins from a total Am Haaretz, knowing nothing, to the Gadol that he became. It's a fascinating story about his pain, his crying, his yearning for Torah, what yearning for Torah can do, his attempt to establish a relationship with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, his tenuous relationship with his father. Really fascinating, brings us up to Rabbi Eliezer, the Gadol that he became. The next chapter focuses on what is the critical turning point in his life, which is the famous machlokus between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chacham about Tanur of Achnai, the status of a particular kind of Tanur. All the Chacham took one position, he took another position. He brought about miracles to prove his point. Finally, a bas kol comes out and says, Rabbi Eliezer, you're right. The Chachamim refused to accept the bas kol. Rabbi Eliezer refuses to recant, and they place him in cherem. And then the aftermath of that cherem is told. Eventually, he burns produce and food, is burnt and is upset in his anger. Eventually, his brother-in-law, Rabban Gamliel, is killed as a result of his anger. It's a fascinating agadata in which, as I try to develop it and explain it, these are people who had the deepest convictions about what Talmud Torah is, what is Torah truth, and they're willing to stake their lives on that. Rabbi Eliezer was willing to stake his life, his whole future. He knew more Torah than anybody else, and yet after he was placed in the cherem, he was completely cut off from the world of Talmidei Chachamim. Can you imagine a worse fate? He devoted, he sacrificed his life to amass a massive Talmud Torah. And then nothing. Until, and this is the third chapter in the trilogy on Rabbi Eliezer, he is on his deathbed. Rabbi Akiva, his prime Talmud, and other Talmidim and colleagues come to visit him on his deathbed to assess whether or not they could reconcile with him on his deathbed and whether or not he ever would change his mind. It's one of the most dramatic human encounters in the Gemara that I have encountered. It's extremely powerful, very deep, very rich. They get engaged in an arcane machlokes about certain halachas. One of the strategies I'd employ throughout this book is exemplified in that chapter, where I suggest that whenever you have a machlokes in halacha, which is embedded in a larger agadic narrative, that the machlokes is in fact chosen by either the, in this case, the chachamim, because it sheds light on the larger framework of the Agada, the psychological, philosophical, theological issues that they are debating. And so I try to decode, so to speak, that machlokas, because one of the biggest questions of all is, they ask him the Shaila, Rabbi Eliezer answers Shaila, nothing to do with Tanur Bachnai, and he says, Tar, then Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says, oh, Chayram is lifted. Like, what is that supposed to mean? Just because he uttered the word Tahar, is that like magic? Why would that ipso facto result in the lifting of the chayrim? It's one of the really big puzzles of that agada. So I try to explain that. And that's the third chapter, which also deals with the fraught, complex, and profound relationship between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva. They were both similar. Both started from zero. Both Amei Ha'aretz became Gedolei Olam, had radically different approaches to Talmud Torah. Rabbi Eliezer, the traditionalist, the follow the Masorah, Rabbi Akiva was kosher ksarim on Torah, which even Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't understand. He was so creative, his interpretation of the Torah, radically different approaches. Can those two reconcile? Talmud, Rebbe, very complex and powerful. Agadita about all of those issues. So that's the first trilogy. Then the fourth chapter is a kind of a comparison between Rabbi Eliezer and Akavia ben Mahalalel, who's a much less well-known Tana, some teachings in Edios, in the Sechus Edios, he's also quoted in Pirkei Avos, but he too is placed in the Cherem. It's a study of what he did, why did he do what he did, what were his convictions, why did he risk his life, fascinating series of Mishnayos in Edios, and it's a I compare Rabbi Eliezer, extraordinarily great Tana, and Akavia, how they chose the paths they did, and the different results of their choices. Rabbi Eliezer, a daf in the Gemara doesn't go by without him almost. Akavia, Pirkei Avos, basically that's it. So that's the fourth chapter. And there's a trilogy of chapters of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, as a young man, impoverished, goes out to, must leave the Beis Medrash with his Chavrusa Ilfa. And Ilfa goes to become a merchant. Rabbi Yochanan returns to the Beis Medrash, becomes the Gadol Hadar that he was, the Rosh Yeshiva. And Ilfa says, you think I abandoned Torah and I don't know what it means to learn just because I'm a businessman? And he climbs the mast of a ship. Climbs the top of a mast of a ship and he says, I will jump off the mast and drown if you can catch me on a single halacha whose origins in the Tosefta I can't catch. Now, that's an amazing scene. What's at stake? What is Ilfa's position? What's Rabbi Yochanan's position? How does Ilfa manage that? Can we go into business and still be Talmidei Chacham? That's what that Gemara deals with. Rabbi Yochanan in his early youth. Then there's the famous story about the Rabbi Yochanan, Reish Lakish, the brigand, the robber, tries to attack Rabbi Yochanan in the Yardane, and Rabbi Yochanan convinces him to become a Talmid Chacham, offers him his sister in marriage. How and why you would offer your sister in marriage to somebody who was a robber or a gladiator who tried to attack you in the river is like a pretty good question, which certainly requires an answer. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish becomes a great man. He did. Another misunderstanding between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rishlakish dies as a result of Rabbi Yochanan's taking offense. Rabbi Yochanan suffers traumatically from the loss of his great Talmud Rishlakish, and he shafdaite, the Gemara says, he loses his mind. His Talmidim daven for him, and he dies. That's the second story. The third one is a story about Rav Kahana that I mentioned, Rav Kahana in the grave. That's the sixth chapter. The last chapter is Chonei Ma'agla, which I've already told you about. So that's basically a trilogy on Rabbi Eliezer, a trilogy on Rabbi Yochanan, and two kodas to each related to the themes of the trilogies.
Now the other question, I shouldn't have added it together, was the one about your sources that you've the
Makbara. Okay, so thank you. So the only way to start learning any Gemara is by looking at the classical sources, whether it's a classic sugya, whether it's a Gadata. We have classical sources. The Marsha, astute observer on the Gemara, has obviously an incredible range of knowledge. The Ein Yaakov, of which there is a relatively new edition, beautiful print, various commentaries brought down on the side, which you can look for further reference. I think the Ein Yaakov is now being translated by Art Scrolls, so some of it is available in English. But that's where you always begin, with the classical sources. However, and I make this clear in the introduction to the book, these classical sources are very valuable. When it comes to agaditas, you want to end up, when it comes to any learning, you want to end up with an account of a sugya, whether the sugya is a classical one or an agadita sugya, with an account of the sugya that works for you. At the end of the day, you have to feel that this is a pshat, a derech in learning up the sugya that you feel makes sense for you. So that's what I aspire to do. I drew upon many of these classical mefarshim because of their incredible knowledge and careful reading and insights, but I wasn't always personally satisfied. It didn't always work for me because I'm living in the 21st century. I'm not living in the 16th or 15th century. When it comes to agadita, when you're trying to understand these agaditas, I always used them. They were very valuable, but I didn't always rely on them for the pshatim that I worked through because, as I say, it had to work for me. So I drew upon that. I drew upon many different sources. I drew upon contemporary scholarship. There's, as I say, a plethora of literature out there in Israel, much of it in Hebrew. I've mentioned some of the sources, Yona Frankel. I have a whole library of books in Hebrew. On this from people who study Talmud academically. There is very little, as I say, in the way of classic rabbinic literature on this. Yes, Rabbi Blau has a book on it, but I looked at the sources that I could find, but at the end of the day, I try to figure out an account of the sugya, asking many, 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 many questions about the agadita that worked for me. And I make no claims that what I say is true. I have no idea if it's true. And I'm not even sure what it means to say that you have a true account of a Gemara. I'm not even sure what that means. All I can say is that what I wrote is helpful to me. If it works for the reader, that's wonderful. But if it doesn't, then it behooves the reader to come up with a different approach to the Gemara that answers the many, 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 many questions that I raise, which provoked my approach. So you don't need to go with my approach, but you need to at least answer the questions to your satisfaction, as I struggled my very best to answer the questions that I asked to my satisfaction. Was I always satisfied? I can't say that I always was, but I certainly tried. We could ask more than that.
So I'm going to include the link to the book in the show's notes. Everyone can check it out. And I think what the last question for you basically is future projects. I mean, I know you already alluded to, you said you're already working on another volume. So that's, I guess, is also that's from your shiurim. That's another more something else you're working on. And is perhaps something else also?
Yes. So as I say, in the past, much of my scholarship, such as it's been, has been in Jewish philosophy. But this has become a late passion of mine. I am finishing up a second volume similar to the first one on agaditas. And you know something? There is an embarrassment of riches. Chazal are full of wonderful, wonderful agaditas. I was actually at one point thinking of thinking of calling the book lapping at the sea, like a dog who is lapping at the sea. That's actually the way Rabbi Eliezer describes himself, as somebody who is lapping at the sea of Torah. And unlike his Talmidim, who are like, they're just like paints in a little paintbrush and a little paint, but he is lapping at the sea. And there's such a Yama Talmud out there. Chazal have bequeathed us such wisdom and such powerful, deep stories that there's just a lot out there. And the more I learn, the more I come across, I got it, is that I feel I really need to work on this. And I will tell you, just as an aside, maybe it's not so relevant, but you know, I've been giving a lot of, over the years, given Shiurim at Lander on this, and it never fails that the Talmidim will come up with insights and ideas that I didn't have. I may have learned that Gemara 20 times, again and again and again, and worked on it and worked on it. And it's amazing how somebody with a fresh perspective will see something that I didn't see. You think, like, I mean, I worked on this Gemara for many, many, many hours, 20 times. How come you saw something that I didn't see? And the answer is that these agadotas are so rich that every human being brings to it his sensitivities, his history, his perspective, and it grows and grows and grows. So there's a whole Yama Talmud out there, and there's a lot of lapping that we can do to try to draw from the Chachma of Chazal to the best of our abilities.
Okay, so thank you very much for joining me. Like I said, I'll put the link to the book, Sefer, and everyone can check it out.
My pleasure. Good to schmooze.